The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I feel very short. Before we get started, put your phones on silent, please. And flash photography is not allowed. After James talks, we're going to have a book signing upstairs in the lobby, so join us afterwards up there. And he gets beer, I do not. Okay, James Breakwell is a professional comedy writer and a father of four girls aged 7 and under. He's been named the 2016 Blogger Dad of the Year by Closer Magazine. His exploding unicorn Twitter feed has, I did have written down almost a million followers. He has just informed me that he has hit a million by now. Yay! And he's also the mind behind Twitter's Very Lonely Luke Twitter feed with Star Wars coming up. That would be an exciting one to check out. As well as the webcomics Unbelievably Bad, Wombat Dojo, and Unfridgeworthy. His first book is Only Dead on the Inside, A Parent's Guide for Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse. Whether you have kids or not, Breakwell's adventures in parenting four small kids and a pet pig will make you laugh. So without any further ado, James Breakwell.
Hello, everybody. I am James Breakwell. Thank you for coming to see me today. And I do hope you're here to see me today. If you're here to see some other better speaker, I have some bad news. I am not the warm-up act. This is it. This is the time of year where the really good public speakers are all booked solid. My schedule, wide open. I think you're about to see why. I did get some public speaking tips, though, from my extended family before I came here. My late uncle was a big shot CEO, and he used to give speeches to other big shot CEOs. And that's a tough crowd, because, I mean, those are rich and powerful people who are used to giving orders and not having their time wasted. So I asked one of my aunts, because my uncle passed away several years ago, I asked her, what was his secret? How did he get so good at public speaking? She thought about it for a second and she said, well, every time before he went on stage, he smoked a joint. And that's when I realized I need better role models. You'll be relieved to hear I did not smoke anything before coming to talk to you today. I would never disrespect you by impairing my ability to speak. With that being said, there is a beer right here on the podium, and I may or may not have hit the hotel bar across the street, so just bear with me. Speaking of bad decisions, I wrote a book. It's called Only Dead on the Inside, A Parent's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse. You might have heard me mention it once or twice or a million times. Once you become a published author, you don't end sentences with a period. You end them with, and you should buy my book. Well, I guess after the word book, you would need another period. I mean, you would think I would know how sentences work since I did just write a book, and you should buy it. So just to talk a little bit about, you know, why I did this. I mean, when people find out I wrote this book because, you know, I tell them, their first question is always why. But they don't say it like that. It's always more like, why? Like you gotta kind of see the facial contortion to get the real meaning. Like, why would I write A Parent's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse? And it really comes down to three reasons. It comes down to competition, fear, and freedom. And this isn't a TED Talk, so I'm not going to repeat competition, fear, and freedom to you again, even though I did just repeat them. But I will not say them three times. Twice is where I draw the line. So competition, who am I competing with? I'm not competing with other authors. I mean, I'm not, unless I sold more books than those other authors, in which case I absolutely was competing, and I won. But if I didn't sell more books than those other authors, I wasn't competing. I mean, we don't do this for the book sales. We don't do this for the money. We do it for the art. I do it for the money. So who am I competing with? I'm competing with my own kids. I've created a bit of a unique problem for myself. You guys probably don't know this about me, but I have a Twitter account. Okay. Hide your shock, please. I'm trying not to let a lot of people find out about it. But on this Twitter, actually, I'm curious. Is there anyone on here who didn't find out about me through Twitter? Is there anybody who just like wandered in here by random? You are a trooper, and you're probably going to be very confused by the rest of this speech. But yeah, on this account, I write jokes about my kids. And some of these jokes are real, and some are exaggerated, and some are made up. But most are at least inspired by my kids. I couldn't write these jokes if I didn't have real children as a starting point, or I wouldn't know what kind of jokes I could even write. If I didn't have real kids as a starting point, I mean, I wouldn't write about my kids running away through doggy doors, because that sounds ridiculous. And if you're from Child Protective Services, that has never in my life happened. But if you're not from there, it's happened 3 times, and it's just, you would think I would learn. They should put locks on those things. So that's kind of given me the range. So when I started writing these jokes, my fear was that if I had an account like this, where some of it was real, and some of it was exaggerated, and some of it was made up, that people would just assume it was all made up, and it would kind of lose some of its humor value, because people would assume it was all fictional. And I ended up actually having the opposite problem. I have so many people who tell me, they basically think that every single thing I write is true. They think my kids are kind of these witty, brilliant geniuses, and I'm just the useless stenographer recording their greatness. I can't tell you how many times somebody has told me, well, you're not funny, but your kids are funny, so I want to meet your kids. And first of all, that's a little insulting, and second of all, it sounds like a setup for a kidnapping, so no, I'm not going to let you meet my kids. But it is a problem that I've run into repeatedly. And I kind of had to figure out how to deal with that. Because you wouldn't go up to a stand-up comedian and be like, well, your routine was really funny, but you're not funny. The world is funny, and you were just making observations about an already funny world. I mean, that's kind of how comedy works. The observation is the humor. I mean, we all live in the same funny world. We all have the same funny kids. I mean, not exactly the same kids. I'm not looking to co-parent your children. I have enough of my children already. Please don't give me more. My wife would kill me. But you get the idea. I mean, your kids are witty and funny too. And it's just a kind of a matter of capturing that. And you don't really recognize it as a skill until you encounter somebody who's bad at it. I mean, we all have that friend or coworker who or relative who's like, oh my gosh, my kid just did the funniest thing. And then they start talking and talking and talking. And like, you know, every few minutes you let out one of those awkward half laughs, hoping that's the end, and it's not. And then finally at the end they stop talking, and if you're not sure if that's your cue to like do your big fake laugh or maybe just like do a barrel roll out the window. And I've kind of learned to avoid that trap. I mean, first of all, I never tell my jokes near open windows. But more importantly, I've kind of learned to capture the essence of the joke, to take that 9 minutes of real life and condense it down to the part that matters, the part you want to hear, whether that's completely true or whether you have to exaggerate it to get the point across or whether you have to make some of it up to get the point across. Kind of that's where I come in. And I realize the irony of complaining about somebody who tells a 9-minute joke as I stand up here talking to you for 30 minutes. But you know what? I fill the size of my container. If you give me 140 characters, I'm going to use 140 characters. If you give me 280, I'm going to use 280. And if you give me 30 minutes, I'm going to use 30 minutes. And God help us all. So that's the skill I've kind of been working on all these years. I've kind of carefully honed for thousands of hours the way to capture this story and tell it in a way that's very specific to Twitter. It's a skill that really is entirely useless outside of Twitter. I mean, just think of how my life would be different if I took those thousands of hours and put them into something else like math. But I didn't do that. I put it into writing free jokes for you guys. Do I regret it? Absolutely, but it's too late to change now, so here we are. So that's what I've done. And I was afraid that if my first book, rather than being, you know, only dead on the inside, this parent's guide to surviving the zombie apocalypse, I was afraid if it was just a straight tweet book, if I just took my timeline from Twitter but made it better by charging you money for it in printed form, that I would lose out in the long run, that people would buy this book. And then my next book would be something else. Maybe my next book would be a zombie book, or my next book would be a sci-fi book, or whatever, some other type of comedy book. And I was afraid that people would say, well, we're really just in it for your kids. They're the funny ones. We're out. So I will write that tweet book someday. I absolutely will. Not because it needs to be written, but because there's money there and I'm a total sellout. It just can't be the first book. So someday, I mean, ideally 4 or 5 or 6 books down the road, when I'm finally convinced people I can write a joke, you'll see that tweet book on store shelves. Or maybe it'll be, you know, right after this book, when no other publishers will talk to me and they stop taking my calls, and I'll get back in touch with them and say, hey guys, remember way back in the beginning, the one and only book you wanted me to write, the one I refused to write? Here it is. Please pay me money. So when you see that tweet book on store shelves, it's either the high point or the low point of my career, and you'll just have to buy it to figure out which one. So that kind of covers competition. That's why I avoided the tweet book. But that doesn't say why I wrote this specific book. I mean, that leaves literally an infinite number of other books I could have written, all of which probably would have been better than this book. So why did I pick A Parent's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse? It all comes down to fear. So in its most basic form, this book is really an extended tweet. I start with something that's real. This is what it's like to be a parent. And I extend into something that's exaggerated. This is what it's like to be a parent in a world with no food or electricity or running water. And then I extend into something that's made up. You know, this is what it's like to be a parent in a world with no food or electricity or running water, in a world where the dead are trying to eat you. Now, when I get to that last moment, the made-up part, I went kind of dark there. Like, I could have made up anything else. I could have been like, this is what it's like to raise kids in a world where unicorns are real, or this is what it's like to raise kids in a world where everybody can fly, or maybe this is what it's like to raise kids in a world where the public bathrooms are always clean. And those sound like wonderful worlds. I mean, I spent all day today in an airport terminal. I would love to live in clean bathroom land, but I couldn't go there because that didn't really pertain to parents. I wanted to play to parents' strengths. And what parents are good at is being afraid. Now, if I were a professional speaker, this is the point where I would tell you that fear is bad. You've got to overcome your fear, set aside your fear, conquer your fear, and you have to make a fist when you do it or it doesn't work. But I'm not a professional speaker, okay? I flew here today on a flight that didn't have a carry-on bag, and I may have forgotten to pack a shirt. So let me just tell you, as an amateur, that fear is good. Fear is what keeps you alive. If you walk up to the edge of a cliff and you're afraid, the fear isn't the problem. The fall is the problem. Going splat at the bottom is the problem. Fear is what tells you there's a very realistic worst-case scenario that we need to be aware of here, and we need to take some steps against it, you know, specifically some steps backwards. You know, fear is like, it's like the check engine light in your car. Like, when the check engine light comes on, that little light isn't the problem. The thing it's warning you about is the problem. And you can ignore that fear, you can ignore that check engine light, but then something really bad could happen. And for the record, I always ignore my check engine light. Don't do that. Give in to your check engine light and give in to fear. The only problem with fear is, as parents, we're too good at it. We learn to be afraid in a world that's much more different, much more dangerous than the world we're in now. I mean, biologically, we're the same as Homo sapiens who lived, you know, 200,000 years ago. You know, we have the same fear responses, the same chemicals and hormones go through our bodies. But back then, the consequence for being a bad parent wasn't that your kid got into a bad school. The consequence was that your kid got eaten by a giant bear. I mean, this was a really high-stakes environment. And we take that fear and we bring it to the modern world today. And that's why when your kid is a few minutes late getting home from school, you don't think, oh, they suffered a minor delay. You think, oh, they were murdered in a sewer by a clown. Like, the parent brain just transitions straight from slight delay to clown murder with no steps in between. And it's because we're still in caveman survival mode. We've got these skills and we've never turned them off. And it's kind of overkill. And that's not to say we don't need them. I mean, we do still need them, and we practice them every day. I mean, when you're a kid, if you've got a toddler out there, your toddler doesn't deal with giant bears, but your toddler might find a small Lego on the ground. And what does your toddler do with that Lego? Does he think, oh, I could build a tiny Lego house and express myself through architecture? No. He says, I bet I could take this tiny Lego and jam it down my throat. And then you save his life with the Heimlich maneuver because you were always afraid he was going to choke, and you prepared for it. Your fear keeps him alive. And it's not just, the biggest threat isn't just our kids to themselves today. It's the people who are trying to keep our kids safe. I mean, do you know how many items that have been made to keep babies safe that have been recalled for killing babies? It's approximately all of them, 100%. Every crib, every bassinet, every stroller, every single one of them recalled. So you've got to be on guard. I mean, look at car seats. I come from Indiana. In Indiana, you've got to keep your kid in a car seat until they're like 19. It's crazy. And I do it because who wouldn't put their kid in a car seat? A car seat is designed to keep your child safe. But have you ever read the warning label on an infant child car seat? It says, warning, if your child falls asleep in here, they will suffocate. Like, what? Like, you want me to strap my child into a suffocation seat? And as a bonus, let's take that suffocation seat and turn it around backwards, just to add to the challenge level. And I've never, and I know they say you're supposed to keep your kids awake in the car seats the whole time. I've never seen a parent actually do it. Maybe you guys are the good parents out there who do it, but like, what do you do on a two-hour car trip? Are you going to lean around backwards and poke your kid like every 15 seconds so they scream the whole way? Who would do that? And if you do that, your kids stay safe, but you're going to drive off the road because you've been listening to 2 hours of screaming. So this is the world we're dealing with. We've taken giant bear survival skills and we're applying them to Legos and car seats. Okay, and it's a bit much. So with this book, what I wanted to do is take those survival skills and apply them again to a world where we're not at the top of the food chain, a world where there are big consequences, a world where we are really scraping to get by. And to me, that world was the zombie apocalypse. I wanted to see how parents would do. And the results were pretty encouraging. Parents are going to do great. I mean, assuming you buy my book, you're going to do great. I mean, look at all the great things you're doing with fear right now, even before you become a parent. I mean, what do you do if you have a college term paper? Like, okay, anyone here who's had a college term paper, do you start that paper a month out? Show of hands. Anyone started a month out? You were lying. Nobody starts it a month out. You start that paper the night before it's due. And why do you start that paper the night before it's due? Because you have fear on your side. The fear focuses you. It makes you write faster. It makes you write better. It prevents you from falling asleep because you know the consequences of not getting that paper done. If you don't, you know, if you don't finish that paper, you're going to flunk the class. If you flunk the class, you're going to flunk out of college. And if you flunk out of college, you're going to end up writing zombie books for a living. And there's nothing worse than that. So you've got fear to focus you and make you a better writer. Fear makes you stronger. I mean, how many headlines have you seen about a panicked mother who lifts a tractor off her trapped child? She panics and she has that super strength. I mean, I guess this is Philadelphia. Maybe you guys don't lift tractors around here. I don't know what's big around here, like those sandwiches? Trucks? Okay. Lift a truck off your baby. But have you ever seen a headline where a perfectly calm mother lifts a tractor or a truck just for the heck of it? No, you can't do that if you're not panicked. Panic makes you stronger. I mean, panic, even the fear of embarrassment makes you better. It makes you better as a parent, and it makes you better as a zombie survivor. Now, as a parent, what's your greatest fear of embarrassment? I think for most of us, it's that your kid is going to throw a temper tantrum in public, that they're just going to go ballistic and embarrass you in a crowded restaurant or someplace like that. But because of fear, we've learned to deal with that. I mean, a temper tantrum is kind of like a nuclear war. Like, you can't have half a nuclear war. You either launch the missiles or you don't. Like, your kid either throws the temper tantrum or they don't. It's all or nothing, and it's their max level of anger. It's them being as bad as they can possibly be. And right now, in this safe world, they throw it over dumb stuff. They throw it because, you know, their favorite socks are in the wash, or they throw it because their favorite TV show had a commercial, or they throw it because the world exists. I mean, they don't really need a reason. They go from nothing to, you know, complete absolute anger, and there's no level above that. And you've dealt with that. You've dealt with that in good times. I mean, what do you do if your kid throws a temper tantrum in a restaurant? You do whatever you can to temporarily appease them. You remove them from the scene. And then you put the fear of God in them so they never do it again. And it doesn't work, and 10 minutes later they throw another temper tantrum, but at least you tried. It's the same thing in the zombie apocalypse. What do you do if your kid throws a temper tantrum in the zombie apocalypse? Same steps. Your kid throws a temper tantrum, there's zombies around, you do whatever you can to temporarily calm them down, you remove them from the scene, and you put the fear of God in them, and then they do the same thing tomorrow. But you know these steps. You have seen your kid at their worst. They got nothing else to throw at you. I mean, that's the whole thing about being dead inside. I mean, they've broken you down and built you back up. And that's why parents are going to do better than anybody else in the zombie apocalypse. So that covers competition and that covers fear. But what about freedom? What does freedom have to do with the zombie apocalypse? Well, nothing, but we're going to try to shoehorn it in here anyway. So to me, the zombie apocalypse does kind of represent freedom. Because my biggest fear isn't that my kids are going to get eaten by zombies. My greatest fear isn't even that my kids are going to turn out like me, although maybe it should be. That is a pretty terrifying scenario. But really, my biggest fear of all is that I'm never going to write my way out of a cubicle, that I'm going to be there for my whole life just as a part-time writer and a part-time whatever else I do, who knows, and that it won't work. And so the zombie apocalypse scenario is kind of an escape scenario. It's, in my mind, it's kind of like winning the lottery. When you fantasize about winning the lottery, what do you think about? I don't think you think about the day you buy a mansion or think about the day you buy your third yacht or think about the day you build a giant money vault like Scrooge McDuck so you can swim through all your gold coins. Oh, you should still do all those things. I mean, if you're not taking your financial planning advice from DuckTales, I don't know what you're doing with your life. But I think the part that we actually fantasize about is the day you quit your job. The day you walk into your job, to your boss's office, and you say, you know what, take this job and shove it. And you get up on his desk, and you dance the jig, and then you remember you don't know how to do the jig, and you fall off and twist your ankle, and all your coworkers point and laugh at you, and you say, to hell with all of you, I don't need people, I have money. And you hold your head high, and you limp out the door. That was an oddly specific lottery scenario. Your lottery scenarios may vary, but you get the idea. It's the freedom that you're fantasizing about, not so much the money. And to me, the zombie apocalypse scenario is the same sort of thing. It's the idea of escape. You know, in my mind, it happens like this. I'm sitting at my desk at work. It's 3 o'clock. I'm bored out of my mind. I can't think of how I'm possibly going to survive the next 2 hours. And then a miracle happens. The dead start eating the living. Say, hey, boss, I'm out of here. The world just ended. I'm not going to clock out. I'm not going to take vacation time. I didn't quit the job. The world quit on me. And then you go home, and you never set the alarm again. I mean, from then on, you're basically self-employed. You're just in the business of survival. It's got a certain appeal to it, other than the unfortunate side effect that everyone you know or love gets eaten. But I think it's worth it. I'm willing to pay that price. So that's what it means to me. And to me, it doesn't just represent freedom kind of in the metaphorical sense, but it really kind of moved me an actual step closer to freedom. Because by writing this, you know, that's another book to your credit. That's more income. That's something that gets you invited out to Philadelphia to waste half an hour of people's time. I mean, it's a step in the right direction. And I don't know if I could have written this book if I wrote a different kind of parenting book. I mean, a lot of parenting books out there, they do this crazy thing where they give you like actual factual information, and I can't think of anything worse. You go out and you interview parenting experts and you get knowledge and you look at studies. I mean, that's a job. I've got a job. And ever since I started writing, I've always done it because it's fun. And that was the only way I've been able to do it all these years, because you have to. I mean, if you're going to make it to anything like this, I mean, you write jokes for years and years before it ever pays off. I looked at something I wrote the other day in 2003 when I was in high school, and it was fairly funny, and I was kind of impressed with myself because I was funny way back then, and I was kind of disappointed in myself that I haven't evolved at all, but that's okay. You take with the good with the bad sometimes. So that's I needed to write something fun, something out there, if I was going to squeeze in this book between a full-time job and between raising kids and between running the Twitter account and doing the webcomics. And I guess that's one place that I really shouldn't complain about my job, and maybe you guys shouldn't complain about yours, because the greatest asset in the world is a job that sucks. I mean, specifically a job that doesn't take much mental ability, that you can kind of just zone out during the day, because though they can physically confine you someplace, they can't stop you from daydreaming. I mean, Albert Einstein, you know, daydreamed, I think it was at the Swiss patent office or one of the patent offices. He was a low-level bureaucrat, and he daydreamed up the theory of relativity. I mean, I daydreamed up a parenting guide to, you know, a parent's guide to surviving the zombie apocalypse. Is that as impressive as the theory of relativity? I don't know. We'll see which one saves more lives. But you get the idea. There's that freedom there to kind of reach out and do that. And I guess there's also freedom to just getting buy-in from people. I mean, if you guys hadn't come out to see me today, if you wouldn't follow me on Twitter, if you wouldn't do things like that, I wouldn't have the freedom to experiment. Nobody would take a chance on me with a book like this. They would make me write one specific book or not any book at all. I mean, there are so many Twitter accounts out there from best-selling authors, and you look at them, and they have 5 or 10 or 20,000 followers, but they have 5 or 10 or 20,000 followers who bought every single one of their books. And they loved their books so much, they wanted to see what they were saying in between those books. And so they followed them on Twitter. They went from the paid to the free. I mean, I'm coming at this from the opposite angle. I mean, I've got, a million people who will read my jokes for free, and I'm still looking for the 10 or 20 or 30,000 people who will buy every book. And I'm hoping that's you guys. I got 20 out of a million here tonight. That's better than I thought, so we'll just keep building on that. But that's, and that's what it takes. So I do appreciate you guys taking a chance on me. And I think there's, I'd like to think it's because we all kind of view the world in the same way. Kind of the anti-Facebook idea. If you're offended and you're on Facebook or you're watching the stream on Facebook, I apologize. But I think on Facebook is the worst offender, maybe Instagram, where you try to portray your life in the most perfect way. You know, everything is great. My kids are great. I'm great. There's nothing wrong. And I mean, that couldn't be further than from real life. I mean, what I've excelled at, I think why my Twitter account went viral is because we all want the flaws. We all want to see other people who are messed up, specifically more people who are more messed up than us, so we feel better by comparison. And maybe that's what I am to you guys. You just find a parent who's a little bit worse than you and just follow them, so every day you can say, okay, I'm not rock bottom yet. And I'm okay to fill that role, because the things that make us broken are the things that make us great. And maybe I'll never be great. In fact, I will probably never be great. But maybe in my case, the things that make me broken are the things that make me average. And I'm okay with that. You know, that's probably exceeding what my expectations were. And I've gotten there because of you guys. I've gotten there because, you know, despite the competition with my kids, you're willing to take a chance on me. I've gotten there because you embrace the fear of parenting like I do. I've gotten there because you were willing to take a chance on my freedom to write something else other than a Twitter book. And I appreciate that. So really, this book is as much your book as it is mine, but you still have to pay for it. So thank you very much for inviting me here today, and thank you very much for letting me take up half an hour of your time. I really do appreciate it. All right, so I think we're going to do some questions now. I'm going to drink this beer while we do this. Go ahead.
What's the pig's name?
The pig's name is Gilly. We named her after the Game of Thrones character. If we had a boy pig, we would have named him Hodor, which is probably a much better name. But boy pigs get a lot bigger, and they kind of look scary. So we went with a girl pig, and Hodor is not a good name for a girl pig. So we went with Gilly.
Did the wife feed the pig?
I hope she did feed the pig. I hope I don't come back and find the pig dead. But the pig is pretty resourceful. She finds food where there is none, so I hope she'll make it.
How is it being the only man in your family? Everyone is a girl?
You know, I don't notice it all that often. I mean, kids below a certain age are kind of androgynous. I mean, they like Star Wars and zombies and all that. They like princesses, too. So there's a mix. And you don't notice it for except it. Kind of really weird, unexpected times. Like there was one time we were getting ready for a wedding, and my wife had washed everybody's dresses, and they were hanging up, you know, drying. And I walked in there, and I was the only one in the house who was ready. It took me 2 minutes. And I walk in there, and I see five dresses across there all drying. And it's like, oh my God, I am so outnumbered, and we are never making it to this wedding on time. So it does. It hits you at moments like that.
Do you know what your kids are scared of? Like what their biggest fears are?
They are afraid of pretty much everything, honestly. They're afraid of the dark. They're afraid of loud noises. It comes up at random times. There is so much crying in my house. Like if my Twitter account were more accurate, every tweet would end and begin with crying and probably have some crying in between. And I edit that out, and that's the only reason they're funny. If I left the crying in there, I would just seem like the worst parent ever, and somebody would come take away my kids.
So is that true that you sat at your job and then came up with this idea to write the book? And
I do.
You followed through and did it from that?
Yeah, I do so many things at my job that I shouldn't. my coworkers just finally found out. I made it 5 years on Twitter with my face being everywhere before they found out. And they only found out because it was in the Indy Star one day, and one of the older employees who still read newspapers happened to buy it, and he didn't usually buy it. But before then, they had no idea. And when they did find out, we happened to be in between bosses, so nobody in management still knows. So I'm in the clear. But yeah, that's what a lot of my day is, honestly. I sit there and I do my job and I go over and I think, what did my kids do or say today? Let's build some jokes over the things that happened. So during the week, the tweets aren't live, but they're kind of usually based on that first chaotic hour in the morning where I have way more contact with my kids than they ever wanted. It is awful trying to get all four of them out the door, and then they kind of become live again at the end of the day when I go home. So yeah, that's not a lie. I really do that. And that's one of the reasons why, as much as I want to get away from the job, job, I kind of don't want to get away from it either. I mean, as long as I can do both, it's hard to quit someplace with health insurance. Writing zombie books does not have health insurance. So we'll see. So maybe I'll get lucky someday and they'll just fire me and make up the choice for me. But until then, I'm probably just going to keep writing books at my desk. I actually figured out at the end of this book that I could write books on my phone. Before that, I had just written tweets on there, just short things. But I was flying back from LA. I happened to get an ad deal out there, and I couldn't for the life of me fit the laptop on my lap on those tiny airplane chairs. And I just did it on my phone, and it was incredible. And this, my next book, which I'm not ready to announce yet, because I want to go all in on this book. Please don't wait for the next book. Please buy this one. But that, the next book, I wrote almost 100% on my phone. And it works because I think slow. And I've heard other authors say this, that they prefer to write their thoughts out because it goes slow enough that they think of the next sentence. With me, swiping on my phone has that slow speed, but with the added advantage that I can actually read it. If I had to write it by hand, I would just give up because I wouldn't have any idea what I had written. I don't remember who I was talking to, but I hope that was you. I hope I answered your question.
I know you keep an alias to weed out the weirdos.
Yeah.
Have you had any obsessive fans? Or
I have one.
Or a reason why?
Well, I mean, to start out, I mean, there were a couple reasons. I didn't want to get fired from my job because, again, there would be nothing worse if my boss had come to me on day one and said, you've got to pick. And I've got one job that pays $0 and one job that pays, you know, not $0. It's a pretty easy choice. And my wife would have made that choice for me. It would have been game over. So I really had to hide at that stage. Now that, I mean, honestly, I'm kind of halfway in both worlds, I would pick writing these days. But that was one reason. And implausible deniability. If they ever catch me, I'd be like, well, my name's different. I mean, you can't prove I'm that person, even though I am here on camera now saying I'm that person. Other than that, you can't prove it. But there are weirdos out there. I mean, especially... there have been, I'm not the first person out there to write parenting jokes, and a lot of people who write parenting jokes won't show their kids at all. They just draw that line and say you're never going to see them, but then they use the real name for themselves. And to me, that's less secure, because if you know the parent's name, you can look them up in public records and find them. I mean, I have a really common name. I mean, it's not like it's a super secret, but if you did find my real name, it wouldn't do you a lot of good, because there'd be a million of people with the same name. So that kind of protects us. And also, I just found I look real generic. I mean, in all those years where people didn't figure it out, my picture was everywhere, I figured out I look like every other white guy. Like, I should commit a murder or something, because they'd never be able to identify me in a lineup. We all look the same. So I had that. And I think my kids are the same, too. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've almost accidentally picked up the wrong kid from daycare. I mean, from behind, those little brown-haired girls kind of all look the same. You gotta kind of really look at them to figure it out. And I never remember what I dressed them in in the morning. If they ever go missing, I'm in trouble. They're going to ask me what I dressed them in, and I'll be like, clothes? I don't know. So hopefully that doesn't happen, and hopefully it won't, because we use the aliases. I did finally have one like fan that scared me the other day. So I have that Lonely Luke account, she got in touch with me through there. And one day, out of the blue, she messaged me and said, "I need your business partner to stop harassing me." I was like, "I don't have a business partner. I barely have a business. Like, what do you think this is?" And I finally got out of her that she thought my business partner was the real Mark Hamill. That Mark Hamill had created a fake account to harass her at my behest. I was like, holy cow, this is a level of crazy I can't deal with. And so I blocked her, and then later on, she went after the pig breeder. She went and started writing negative reviews in the pig breeder and telling her that I needed to contact her because now I was harassing her. And like, so you realize that as crazy as it sounds that I meet you guys and lie to you about my name, like, there are weirdos out there, and it doesn't take a lot of weirdos. It just takes one weirdo. And out of a million people, you're always going to find that one weirdo, and I hope that one weirdo isn't in the room right now. I'm sure you guys are all great, but they are out there, so that's why.
So in 5-10 years, when your girls are teenagers and they find your Twitter account?
They know about my Twitter account now. They only vaguely understand what it means. They go back and forth between thinking it's nothing and thinking that I'm famous. And it's internet fame, so it's neither one of those things. It's kind of a useless in-between. So they get it. And if there's one thing kids love, it's attention. I mean, they just bask in it. So now when they do something crazy, they're like, Daddy, go get your phone. We're doing something. And so I have to go and, you know, if you're going to take pictures of your kids, you got to take 60 pictures to get one or maybe one and a half that work right. So they definitely play along, and they know when like I do videos and things, especially for ads, that they do it, and then I bribe them with candy or whatever else. They get an allowance. They get a W-2 at the age of 7. I felt bad if I didn't give them anything, so we split it. So I try to be fair about that. So hopefully by the time they're old enough for college, there'll be something there. So they are in on it. At the same time, they don't grasp entirely how it works, especially as they go younger and younger. And they're kids. So sometimes they're all in, and then when it's really important that they cooperate, that's when they stop cooperating. You know, you go, we had one time we got this really cool thing where we got to go down to a tree house in Georgia and just post a couple tweets from there, and they would let us stay for free, and it was awesome. It's like, all right, kids, we drove 7 hours, we got to justify this thing, time to do it. And then they just, you know, scream and cry, and like, we had to do a video, and video is the hardest thing in the world with kids. Like, for pictures, it is super easy to lie with a picture. It's like, one kid happy, three kids screaming, take a picture of the happy one. Video, one kid happy, three kids screaming. Yeah, you're going to hear three kids screaming in the background. I'm going to sound like a monster. So that's the challenge. So it's always kind of a give and take with them to get them to cooperate and get on board. And so I hope as they get older, they'll stay on board. But I know how rebellious teens work, and so, you know, who knows what they'll do at that stage. And if they get mad at me, I'll just play up the fiction side and say, this isn't you, this is a character based on you who just happens to act and look exactly like you. We'll see if that works.
So now that your wife has had multiple pictures taken of her, what does she think of it?
I mean, she, you have to understand what this has been like. So you know, when she married me way back in whenever it was, 2007, I mean, I always wanted to do comedy writing, and I never made any money at it, and I was going to be at a newspaper. And she was on board then. She's like, okay, this is what you want to chase, this is what you want to do. She had a good job, fine. So she's on board with it. And gradually, my kind of writing took these tangential turns, but always, it was me taking time away from more important things to do what was essentially a wasteful hobby. So there was always kind of that tension, and rightfully so. I mean, you can't say, I can't do the laundry now, I have to write this really important thing when this really important thing is going to pay you $0. So there was always that kind of that struggle. But as it kind of took off, she was understanding, and she did give it a chance, and that's why I got this far. I mean, honestly, if she had told me at day one, you can't tweet about this family doing these things, I would have been dead in the water. That would have been it. So she was on board. So this account only exists because of her. And to her credit, she has only vetoed tweets like 2 or 3 times. She was probably right to veto them. It's good that I have her there. And now that her picture's out there, I mean, not a lot has changed. I mean, having her as a mystery kind of had a certain appeal to it. There was less pressure because, I mean, I don't care how stupid I look, as you can tell by me standing here right now. But, you know, she definitely doesn't want to look stupid, so we got to, you know, try to take better pictures there, present a little bit better image and up my game some. So that has changed. But she's still on board. She's still supportive. When we do get ads, and we're lucky, and I don't run a lot of ads, but when we do, I mean, she always helps with those because it's really, really hard to wrangle 4 kids, especially out of the house. And I mean, she let me come here today and feed my pig at home. So can't thank her enough for keeping my pig alive. That's what really matters.
You've probably answered this already, but as a parent, mm-hmm. I would be super sensitive about saying anything in my daughter's name.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you're using observational humor. Are these things that your kids actually do or say that you kind of turn into humor? Are they things that you just make up entirely? And are you fearful about how your kids will react when they understand what you're doing?
It's a mix. It really is. It starts out with some nugget of truth. They usually inspire it. They do or say something quirky. And occasionally, I mean, sometimes that's a complete joke. There's a nice back and forth that ends with a punchline and fits concisely somewhere. And I'm like, that's awesome. We're done. And my wife collects those too. She'll tell me this is what the kids did or said. And there's a lot of cases where I change characters. Like if my kid did or said something to my wife, I will change it to me, because it's a joke just isn't funny if you're as funny if you're telling the joke about a third party as it is about you. So we change characters. If it happened to a daycare later, something like that, we'll change characters and make it happen to me. Then there are times where I exaggerate, because the way they said it just doesn't make sense. Like, I get the meaning, but if I write it like they said it, you won't get the meaning. And if I write out the whole thing, it won't make sense. So we get to the same point, but I write a shorter story to get to the same point. And then there are times that I make it up, that these are the kind of things my kids say, and and do. This is the way they act. And I don't think they're going to be resentful because I always make them look good. I mean, there's a reason people think I'm not funny, and it's because I always play the straight man. Every time there's an argument, I'm the loser. I mean, my wife looks brilliant on Twitter. She looks like the wittiest person on earth, and maybe she is. She's really smart, and she's really funny. But there's no way she could have won 100% of our arguments. Maybe 99%, but not 100%. But if you go on Twitter, it's 100% of the arguments. And I mean, she reads what I write about her every day. She reads what I write about the kids every day, and she's on board with it. Now, if I were making my kids look stupid or petty or things like that, I mean, that would be a different story. I don't want to shame my children. I don't want to embarrass my children. But all the feedback I've gotten from the internet seems to be positive. People are really, they really like the way my kids are portrayed. I think the way I try to make them come off is strong, independent, kind of feminist, just they can do things for themselves. And those are kind of their core values in real life. I mean, that's how they're coming up. And as long as I get that essential truth about how they are across, I'm not too worried about the specifics. And I also don't hide them from them. I mean, my oldest girl can read, and anytime they want to know what I've written, I tell them. And then the oldest one especially understands what a joke is. And I really do hope she'll follow in my footsteps, maybe not waste as much time on Twitter as I do, but I hope she learns to write these kind of jokes, because I found it very rewarding, and I hope she will as well.
How often are your daughter's like definitions of words accurate, or do you make them mostly up?
Those are a mix, too. Again, nothing's ever totally true or totally false. It's usually in between. And it's usually with those, they say something really weird, but not quite as weird as what comes across, I would say. I would say most of those are at least exaggerated. There have been a few, and it's my three-year-old who does it. Other people have trouble understanding her. I can understand her pretty well. I actually have an Indy Star column coming out in a few weeks about that, about how I can understand what she says. But she, kids just, they look at the world in a totally different way. And those jokes always do amazing. So I'm always eager when she says something weird. I'm like, what do you think that means? What is that? And sometimes she'll give me something and I can use it. And sometimes I just kind of have to exaggerate what she said. But there's usually a kernel of truth to those, yeah.
Approximately. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you are in your city. You were in high school during 9/11.
Yes.
Is this why you are really you might sound mature, you might sound joker and stuff, but you are so intense for your age. But you are showing it with humor. You know, mm-hmm. Is this has something to do with 9/11, the high schools, the history that you lived?
I'm hesitant to claim influences from 9/11. I went to a college that closed. That's a pretty rare and special thing. They collapsed from gross mismanagement over years, about 10 years after I left, and they sent out a fundraising email the other day. And the fundraising email said, "We've overcome challenges before, like the fire in 77 and 9/11. It's like, how did you overcome 9/11 here in the middle of Indiana? So I don't want to come off like them. I mean, that certainly was a wake-up call. It certainly changed how we looked at the world. I don't know if that made me more intense. I kind of aged prematurely. I've always been a bitter old man. from a very young age. And I don't think, I mean, I maybe am more intense than some, but I think maybe we've gotten kind of this weird idea of extended adolescence where into your 30s you're kind of supposed to be this ridiculous man-child. And maybe I am that man-child, maybe not, but I think that in a regular normal world, definitely in the zombie apocalypse, I think I'd be pretty normal for that. In terms of focus, if you mean by intense, how hard I go at Twitter and all these other things, how seriously I take something that shouldn't be taken seriously at all, I think that's probably just more than anything, one, the drive to prove myself. I did really well in school all the way through, and then you get out in the real world, and I started a newspaper and thought, well, I'll work my way up slowly here and get a humor column, and I quickly realized it was the worst job of my life, and I couldn't take it, and I quit. And then I was kind of adrift. It's like, how do you define yourself? And then I ended up in a cubicle where you really can't set yourself apart, and you can't excel at anything. And that turned out to be a blessing, because when I finally realized I'd hit a wall, I stopped trying. I mean, I did my job, but I didn't put the energy there. I put that intensity back into writing, and that got me going again. So I would say the job is probably more of an influence than anything, and just my own insecurity. You don't want to go to your 20-year reunion and be like, what have you done with your life? I'm like, well, well, I can probably sum it up in a sentence. So hopefully if we do have that 20-year reunion, I'll have a bit more to say. I probably won't mention 9/11, but hopefully have a bit more to say. Okay, well, if anybody wants to buy the book, I will meet you upstairs and gladly sign it, and hopefully you'll be able to read it. Thank you guys so much for coming. I do appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.